Our next guest is David L. Bahnsen. He is the founder, managing partner, and chief investment officer of the Bahnsen Group, a private equity management firm managing over $1.5 billion in assets. David is consistently named as one of the top financial advisors in America. He's a regular contributor to National Review and Forbes. He's the author of the book Crisis of Responsibility, Our Cultural Addiction to Blame and How You Can Cure It. His new book is The Case for Dividend Growth, Investing in a Post-Crisis World, released in April. David Bahnsen, welcome to The Bigger Picture.
It's great to be with you.
Glad to have you. So investing in a post-crisis world, when is this post-crisis world going to happen? It seems like the crisis is never ending these days.
Well, no, I think it's a reference to a very specific crisis that we most certainly did go through as a society, and that obviously is the financial crisis that we, you know, associate with the Great Recession of 2008.
Right.
And so we've kind of had this period of time from an investor standpoint. You're right, there's been a lot of other societal crises and various cultural epidemics that we have had and continue to have. But from the investor standpoint, it's been this sort of a free ride for the last 9 to 10 years post-crisis. And what the book is largely attempting to do is say, okay, as things now restore to normalcy, we're no longer enjoying the bounce back period out of the recession.
Right.
We're not still going to get the Federal Reserve throwing the kitchen sink at things. What do we want to be doing in the next 10 to 20 years?
Well, the Federal Reserve isn't throwing the kitchen sink at things, but it does seem to have stopped raising rates with a rather robust economy going on. Is that going to last much longer?
Is the robust economy going to keep going, or is the Fed sitting on their hands going to keep going?
Well, I was talking about the Fed, but I suppose, yes, if the economy turns around.
You could look at both aspects. I mean, I think that the Fed is right now in kind of a pickle because they realize that the economy is very strong. You have very low unemployment. You have GDP growth. It's been much faster than it has been trendline throughout most of the last 10 years, and yet what they got to see in the fourth quarter of last year is that the free-flowing credit that the economy has gotten very used to really dried up, and it's not going to be so easy to wean the patient off the medicine.
Well, the Trump administration seems to think that the medicine never needs to stop. You get the right people on the Fed, and you get low interest rates forever. Is that a way to go?
Well, besides you and me and whoever's listening to this right now, we'll keep this as a little secret, but I don't think anybody in the Trump administration really believes that, but I certainly think they feel it necessary to say that they think that, and I'll leave it there.
At least one of those nominees has dropped out. I understand Steve Moore is not going to be a nominee to the Fed.
Stephen Moore and Herman Cain both have now dropped out.
Oh, they both
out,
have? Yes. Okay.
Yep.
So in the post-crisis world, which is thoroughly out of crisis at this point, what are we looking at for the next 10, 20 years?
Well, I mean, I think that the reality of history from an investor standpoint is that in any 10 and 20-year period, and you could go longer, you know, generationally, what you're going to get is some really good times and some really bad times and everything in between, and that's normal. And that's what investors have to be prepared for. And the problem is we've started this new millennium with 2 decades now that are both really quite rare. The first decade was the first time since the Great Depression that, in theory, no one made any money for 10 years. Just the coincidence of the calendar. The decade started off with the implosion of
the dot-com bubble, right?
The whole technology bubble, and then you go into 9/11, and then you go into a minor recession. And so you started off with 2.5 years of pain and misery. There was a huge rebound out of that, but then that was all reversed into the mother of them all,
right?
With the financial crisis. And
which
so
by 2010 was hitting bottom.
Exactly. And so the start point to end point was basically a total flat line. And then the next decade is not exactly normal or normative in that you had 9 years in a row of positive equity markets. You had a 370% cumulative return in the S&P 500. Hmm. Now you did have some volatility along the way. There were 54 times since the financial crisis that the market has dropped 5%. But you only had two times that the market dropped 10%.
You mean in
no
a day?
Time. No. In any period at all. From peak to trough.
There were some days, though. There were some good 4% days, weren't there?
There were. And there were a couple, negative 3 and 4% days as well. But I'm saying in terms of actual, high point to low point, very minimal volatility compared to history, mm-hmm. where you would average a 20% drop every 4 years, 10% drops much more frequent, and we really didn't have any of that gravity. Mm. And it's a good thing we didn't, based on how people seem to respond now when the market goes down just 2 or 3%, even as we're sitting here talking now. It looks like the market will open up tomorrow down 500 or 600 points. Behind some of Trump's President Trump's trade comments today, the Shanghai stock market is down over 5% right now as I'm speaking. But see, we haven't had much of that at all lately. And so I think it's healthy for investors to be reminded of the way markets work and that volatility is a part of the game. And I suspect that over the next 10, 20, 30 years, you're going to have a growing economy. And you're going to have companies continuing to innovate in some very profitable activities, some very well-run companies here in the United States, where we have the greatest capital markets in the world. And yet, it will be a good time to remember that things don't always happen easily.
Well, there won't be no recessions at all. We're not in a new normal, are we?
As far as repealing the laws of business cycles, no, we're not. Right.
Well, of course. I have a question for you. Well, what does this mean for, let's say, the 20-something-year-old who's going to college and their investment portfolio versus the 50- or 60-year-old that's about to go into retirement? What does this mean for their investments and their investing strategy?
Well, this is what my most recent book is about that just came out here in the last month, The Case for Dividend Growth. My argument is that whether someone is in their late 50s getting ready to start quote-unquote retirement and in need of consistent income, or one is in their 20s and getting ready to accumulate wealth for their future, that in both cases, I believe investing for the sensibility of actual profitable companies that have a defensible, growing stream of profits from which they are paying out to us as shareholders a growing stream of dividends. That's where investors have traditionally made money in the market, something that's less speculative, that is more defensive, that is inherently something available from better companies, more mature companies, with management that is more aligned with shareholders. And if I was a 23-year-old college graduate who had a few bucks to begin investing, or a 65-year-old who needed a stream of cash flow, in both cases, dividend growth scratches those itches.
So dividend growth is a shorthand for a successful long-term company.
But there are a lot of successful long-term companies. It is. Let's put it this way. It is necessary but not sufficient. So you cannot be a consistent dividend grower if you're not a successful long-term company, but you can be a successful long-term company that's not a dividend grower, and we think that investors need to be focused on those dividend growers from which they can validate the company's wisdom, their own confidence in their own business model. See, it's real cash. Mm-hmm. I always make the analogy of a tax return. There's a lot of people that probably make more money than the tax return says, and I'll let you guess how that might be. But I don't think there's a lot of people I don't think there's a lot of people that make less money than the tax return says. Mm. I don't think that they're paying taxes on money they didn't really make. Right. And with a dividend, it works kind of the same way. You don't have to really question the validity of the earnings. You know, if the company is actually paying out cash to you, it's a statement both about the sincerity of the past and present success, but it's also a vote of confidence about the future.
Hmm. Well, you know, a vote of confidence of the future. What I would like to know is how do we get like the 20-year-olds that we were talking about, you know, with a few bucks to invest, how do we get them to invest it? Because I keep hearing about how the average American doesn't have 400 bucks to spare for an emergency. Nobody's investing. Nobody's saving anything. How do we solve that?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. There is a really important and broad and complicated cultural conversation that has to happen to properly answer your question. And I suspect that there's more than one factor at play here, but if someone said, David, just break down for us what's the singular reason that people in their young 20s are not more prone to invest and are so cash flow tight, I don't think that the number one primary reason would be a lack of budget wisdom or excessive credit card debt.
Really?
All of those things are frequently at play. But if we were forcing ourselves to pin it down to one major category, I do think it's the student loan debt fiasco.
Interesting.
And I have a whole lot of things to say about that mess. But ultimately, if you look at a college graduate who is gainfully employed, one who, after completing their undergraduate work, found some sort of a job, perhaps an entry-level job, but I don't mean, you know, like at Starbucks or something. I'm saying they're starting the professional career that they want to be engaged in and of course, have wages that maybe go along with that. So they're making a living, but not necessarily, you know, swimming in excess cash flow. Right now, that group of people, instead of being able to feel so proud and so accomplished that they've done something that many over the last 10 years have not been able to do, and that is achieve a livelihood, they are facing the just horrifically unfair dynamic of having the highest levels of rent in recorded history or the greatest unaffordability to purchase a home in history, while they very likely are facing well upwards of $200,000 of student loan debt.
Oof.
That you know is going to represent a very significant portion of their monthly cash flow.
Yeah, that's what you get for going to USC, Phil.
I know.
Student loan debt. $200,000 of student loan debt. Well, that's interesting. And I thank you, David Bonson, for being on The Bigger Picture. Appreciate you taking the time.
It's been a pleasure.
All right. This is The Bigger Picture. We will be right back after a couple of minutes.